Chapter 17. Clock Watching. We put on our gecko slippers and lined up at the airlock. I turned around for one last look at the cave in the ice that had been our home for almost 4 years. It would have been 12 without the other's gift of time compression. Hard to imagine 8 more years confinement here. We'd all be crazy as Moonboy. I knew every square centimeter of it better than any place I'd ever lived before, but there was no sadness in parting. I hope never to see it again. A robot crew was coming aboard to maintain it as a historical artifact. It would become a museum, eventually. But first it could see service for other starflights to places nearer than Wolf 25, before its fuel ran out. If it survived whatever was happening tomorrow. "Here you go, girl." Elsa smoothed the patch on the back of my hand. I immediately felt calmer. She gave them to everybody else but Paul and Namir. And Snowbird had her own resources. We secured our luggage in the back, the stern, I suppose, and came forward to strap in. I was right behind Paul, and so had the dubious privilege of being able to watch us land, if my eyes weren't squeezed shut. Namir was in the co-pilot chair, though he'd only flown light planes. More than the rest of us, though I didn't know how much good that experience would be. Paul cheerfully told me it was like landing a slightly streamlined brick. He had been talking quietly over the radio, I assumed to the control people on Earth. He switched on the intercom and said, "Brace yourselves. We're going to kiss this rock goodbye." The steering jets made a low rumble and a sharp hiss. In the forward view screen, the rock-strewn ice fell away. Then a gentle acceleration pressed me back into the soft seat. I half-dozed for an hour or so as we approached the atmosphere. Then the ship started to vibrate and shake, then buck alarmingly, with serious-sounding creaks and pops. It had been more than 6 years since I last went through atmospheric braking, landing on Mars. Earth is more violent, but shorter. And when the red glow faded away, I was looking down at blue ocean. We banked around and started falling toward the desert, which is not at all like home. Too much vegetation and high mountains everywhere. Maybe hills, technically. Mountains to me. I knew the approach angle was going to be steep, but it felt way too much like a vertical drop. I shut my eyes so hard I saw stars, and didn't open them until the huge thump and then jittery scraping as Paul executed a somewhat controlled slide toward some buildings on the horizon. We stopped in a cloud of dust, which rapidly blew away. A vehicle, almost large enough to be called a building, lurched toward us on tracks. Paul swiveled half around. "There's a decontamination unit coming toward us. They say it will only take an hour or so with, quote, a minimum of discomfort. At least for humans. Snowbird, they have to take you to another place." "I'm on Earth, Paul. It's all another place." We all unstrapped and did some stretches. I felt a little weak and had twinges in both knees, but the gravity wasn't too oppressive. It was good to be on solid ground. My wrist tattoo was working again, and it had set itself to the right time zone, 10:32 a.m. So we had about 5.5 hours before something impressive happened.
"Should we say anything?" Merrill said.
"About no," Paul said. "What would we say? What would be safe?"
Namir nodded.
"Some of the pilots and crew might be able to take measures to protect themselves from whatever it is, but then our others get pissed and fry the earth. Or bake it, as Spy suggested. Or cover it with sulfuric acid. Too big a gamble."
The decontamination team hooked their vehicle onto the lander with a crinkled metal tube like the one we used in space. They came on the view screen and asked for me and the other women first. I went through 2 airlocks into a white room where 3 female techs were waiting, clad in heavy protective suits. Merrill and Elsa went into other rooms. They asked me to disrobe and filed all my clothing into individually sealed plastic bags. Then they vacuumed me, an experience that could be full of erotic possibilities depending on who was doing it to you. Then the internal part. They gave me a glass of what they called a super nano laxative,
and warned me not to drink it until I was seated on a toilet. It had a pleasant lime flavor, and a less pleasant explosive effect. A business-like enema completed the charming sequence. All of this internal fortune duly catalogued and sealed away. I was ready for a shower then, and got the most thorough one of my life. Three strong women scrubbing away where angels fear to tread. When I was finally able to dress, they had some fancy and futuristic clothes waiting. Form-fitting, but also form-altering, with smart fabrics that applied light pressure here and there. Very flattering. Hundreds of tiny, bright strings hung from the fabric, revealing and concealing. Men who never gave me a second look back then? Well, they'd be too old to do anything but look now. They gave me a bowl of vanilla ice cream and put me in a darkened room with a couch, and suggested I might want to rest for an hour or so. I got a light turned on, but couldn't find anything to read. No flat screen or cube, obvious. No controls. But I said, "Space news," out loud, and a cube appeared. No projection frame, with a picture of us landing, with this big crawler in the foreground. Then it showed the president, beaming over his beard, congratulating us and saying that he would be out in California for the landing and the debriefing. The station noted that live coverage would begin at 7, Eastern time. They might have a bigger story than they bargained for. I did doze for a little while. It was after 3 when a big blonde tech, whose name I didn't know but who knew parts of me better than Paul did, woke me with the news that I'd been pronounced clean and was wanted at the green room. She stopped me just before I got to the door. "Oh, you wouldn't know this. The president's from Kentucky, and he'll offer you his favorite bourbon. It's 100 proof. You shouldn't refuse, but you might not want too much of it." Doubly true, since all I'd had to eat on this planet was a bowl of ice cream. But hell, I could knock back a couple of shots and ask Professor Gold if he'd like to play some Texas Hold'em. A lot of famous people do seem larger than life when you meet them. I knew Gold had been a large man from his visit with Paul a half-century ago. But now he was an old shaggy bear, moving with slow sureness, glowing with charisma. A man obviously happy with the world he'd helped to make. The world that had 25 minutes to go. His hand was warm and dry. A measured fraction of large strength. "Paul tells me you don't care for spirits," he said. "So instead of a tot of Blanton's, perhaps you'd like a glass of champagne? A big glass?" An assistant came up with the biggest champagne flute I'd ever seen, and I took my place at a round table. There was only one other empty place. No space for Martians? And Namir came in, accepted a glass of bourbon, and sat down. He spooned an ice cube from his water glass and put it in the whiskey. "Should I address you as general?" the president said. "We have no rank together, sir. Only Namir." He nodded and leaned back in a chair that was slightly larger than ours. Slightly higher. "I exercised my right as Grand Inquisitor of this honky-tonk, and asked the scientists whether I might talk with you first. They acted like a bunch of folks who do have a sense of rank, Namir, not to mention tenure, so they agreed." I think our response was appropriate, for 6 people who were trying to behave like a proper audience while actually wanting to scream. 20 minutes. "What I'd like to do, before we go on camera and do all the cube ops, is ask each of you, if it's possible, to sum up your feelings in a line or two." He smiled a wry curve. "Something I can misquote in an off-the-cuff speech. Namir, you're the oldest." "May we speak without fear of being exactly quoted? Let alone misquoted? No one will like what I have to say, and I would as soon have it not be on the record." "There are no recording instruments in this room. You have my word on that." Namir took a sip, and his brow furrowed. "It's not complicated. Never trust them. Not one iota. Not on the most trivial thing. But never forget that we have to live with them." He set the glass down and smiled. "The lone Israeli speaks. I got that with my mother's matzah." Merrill was next. I think we should find a way to disconnect from them. Even if it means giving up free energy. Even if it means giving up space. They're too powerful and too unpredictable.
Gold chuckled. Watch out, Meryl. That attitude could get you elected in 30 states.
Elza?
I think we're in a position like a child with a toxic, abusive parent, who is also extremely rich. So our problem is twofold. Can we live without the wealth? And can we leave it somehow without the parent exacting revenge?
I disagree with you both, Dustin said.
Your turn.
We can't maneuver our way out of this, Mr. President. They're too powerful, and they've said outright that they're testing us. We have to pass the tests. Channel all our energy right there. Maybe they'll give us an A and leave us alone.
And if we fail the tests?
The air shimmered, and a hollow of snowbird appeared between the two men. I have been listening. Sorry for not appearing. If you fail the tests, then you cease to be. If you were Martians, then that would be of little consequence.
So if we were Martians, Gold said, the problem would disappear, along with us.
Her image pressed her head. You are a humorist, Mr. Gold.
That's a non-answer, Dustin said.
Wait, the president said, and touched his ear.
Oh my God.
I looked at my wrist. It was 1622.
Pipe it in here.
He shook his head angrily.
Jesus Christ! They don't need clearance to see the fucking moon?
An auditorium-sized cube suddenly filled a third of the room. It was London, the Thames at midnight. Ancient Ferris wheel lighting up the darkness. The full moon's reflection a rippling ladder up the river. The moon suddenly changed. It became brighter, and the markings on its face faded to an even glow. It grew to double its size, triple. And then it faded into a fuzzy, round cloud, glowing dimmer as it grew.
Was that the others? The president said unnecessarily. They actually blew up the moon?
It could be a lot worse, I thought. Still could be.
They sent a message just before it happened.
The weird night landscape faded to be replaced by a huge face, all too familiar. Spy. You lied to us, it said. You sent emissaries, machine and man, to say that you were pacifistic. In return for our aggressiveness, you said you sent a plea for peace and understanding. All the while, for 50 years, you were building a gigantic fleet of warships hidden from us.
Not for invasion,
the president cried, as if the image could hear.
Just to protect Earth.
Those 1,000 ships are about to be destroyed, it said. We are going to disassemble your moon and use it for ammunition. From gravel-sized pebbles up to huge boulders. High-speed projectiles will target every warship and all their support. Other rocks will destroy every smallest satellite structure. Your space elevators will have fallen by dawn. All of the space between the Earth and what is now the moon's orbit will be filled with gravel. Any spaceship you attempt to launch will be a sieve before it leaves cislunar space. We do this with a spirit of charity and generosity. You must realize that we could easily drop mountains on the Earth, and humans would go the way of the dinosaurs. But we do want to give you another chance and see what you do with it. This is your last test. I am speaking to you from the crater Clavius. In a few moments, it will cease to exist. The face disappeared. The Thames was dark except for the blinking lights of emergency hovercraft. A brilliant meteor lanced through the sky. Then two more. Then another pair. We sat in stunned silence. I would never see Mars again?